A boom in natural gas is underway. New gas fields have opened up thanks to an advanced drilling technique. It allows gas to be extracted from underground shale rock formations. Natural gas is a cleaner burning fuel than coal or petroleum, though extracting it is still hard, dirty work. And some people who live near major gas projects are complaining. NPR's John Burnett has this story from the massive Barnett Shale gas deposit in North Texas.
To date, there are more than 12,000 gas wells in the Barnett Shale. It's a vast rock formation that underlies 5,000 square miles surrounding Fort Worth. To get the gas to market requires an underground highway of pipelines and compression stations. These big internal combustion engines make noise and spew pollutants into the air day and night. State records show that in the past decade, the number of gas compressors in the Barnett has jumped from a few hundred to 1,300. And they're getting closer and closer to populated areas.
My name is Calvin Tillman. I'm the mayor of a small town of Dish, Texas, the home of free Dish Network satellite TV, and it is also known for 11 natural gas compression stations.
Tillman stands in a field next to the compressor complex along a fence line of trees that died after the engines moved in. His tiny town changed its name to Dish in return for free satellite TV. But the corporate trade-off with the gas companies has been less beneficial. The compressors sit on the southern boundary of Dish. The mayor repeatedly complained to state regulators about smell, noise, and health problems that his residents were reporting, but nothing happened. So last summer, Dish spent 15% of its $70,000 annual budget on a private environmental consultant.
And the air study showed extremely high levels of both carcinogens and neurotoxins, and so this has caused us a lot of concern.
A memo written last week by the top toxicologist at the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality expressed concern that the presence of benzene, a potentially cancer-causing toxin, detected near the compressors could pose long-term health risks. Megan Collins, a 32-year-old pediatric nurse, lived with her husband, a firefighter, and their two small children downwind from the compressors. She started having unexplainable symptoms. Headaches, dizziness, blackouts, muscle contractions. She got test after test while her condition worsened, but she never really worried about the compression stations.
We just always constantly heard the noise, constantly smelled the fumes, but every time we would ask, they would always just say that it was normal.
Then Collins read a newspaper story about the results of the Dish air emissions study. She says since her family has moved away from town, her symptoms have begun to ease.
I'm convinced, sadly convinced, that it's the emissions. I mean, for doctor after doctor after doctor to tell me that I'm a mystery.
While Megan Collins grew sicker, something strange began to happen to Lloyd Burgess's horses. He runs a trucking company next to the compression station, and he used to board horses on his property.
Had a stallion in here that we lost, ended up dying. Had another mare in the same stall. She got a neurological defect and went blind in both eyes and had to put her down. Had a stud in the first stall down there. Had him here for about 2 years. He got sick. Had to move him somewhere else.
No Dish resident has been able to prove the compression stations made them or their animals ill. For their part, the five gas companies that own the compressors have criticized the Dish air emissions study as flawed and inconclusive. They maintain their facilities do not affect public health. The Texas Pipeline Association says its members are anxious to work with cities to resolve these issues to the benefit of both sides. Terry Larson is a spokesperson for Enbridge Energy, which owns three compressors in Dish.
We're in compliance with state regulations. We are concerned about this issue. We are investigating it fully. We have been responsive. We'll continue to be responsive to requests from Mayor Tillman and our neighbors.
There's also the noise issue. Away from Dish, about an hour and a half southeast of Dallas in Freestone County, retired engineer Charles Morgan expected to live out his days drinking coffee and watching his cows on his ranch. Then in 2005, the compressors started moving in. Morgan stands on his fence line, overlooking 10 steel buildings that house the compressors, which together exceed 12,000 horsepower.
I lived here for 21 years, perfect health, don't even take an aspirin until these things showed up. And when they really started running them up, that's when all these problems started occurring.
Morgan claims the constant low-frequency roar from the compressors has twice ruptured his right eardrum and caused him such distress at times he's checked into a hotel. A neighbor who lives on the other side of the compressor station confirmed he and his infant daughter also suffered ruptured eardrums. A spokesman with Anadarko Petroleum, which owns the compressors, says the company is committed to being a good neighbor and that Morgan refused attempts to take acoustic readings at his house. Morgan says he doesn't trust the company. At the moment, most of the concern in Texas is focused on air emissions more than noise, which is scarcely regulated in rural areas. The worry is that compression stations may individually meet state and federal regulations for air emissions, but what's the cumulative effect of a complex like the one at Dish?
If you were to aggregate the emissions from all of these 11 compressor engines and all of the associated piping and meters and valves and everything else at these facilities, you can get a significant source of emissions, hundreds of tons per year.
Al Armendariz is an environmental engineer at Southern Methodist University in Dallas who wrote a widely circulated report earlier this year. He estimated gas production, processing, and transmission in the Barnett Shale produces nearly as much air pollution as all the region's vehicle traffic. State regulators validated his numbers.
So our conclusion was that the oil and gas production industry around Fort Worth is a major contributor to both local and global air pollution problems.
Gas booms are coming to other shale formations around the country, in Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma. Armendariz warns if the industry is contaminating the air and making people sick, and if regulators aren't doing enough about it, communities won't want the drilling rigs. Dish Mayor Calvin Tillman has some hard-earned advice.
If you don't learn from what has happened here, by the time that the odor gets bad enough for you to not want it there, by the time that the noise gets loud enough that it's disturbing you, it's already too late.
Concerned that gas facility emissions may be more hazardous than previously thought, Texas air quality regulators have undertaken a large-scale air monitoring project in the Barnett Shale. Results are expected early next year. One of the places they tested is the town of Dish. John Burnett, NPR News.
One of the most soaring voices in the world has taken a dive. The voice belongs to Placido Domingo, and the dive is into the deeper reaches of that voice. This fall in Berlin, the great tenor is singing a leading role as a baritone. Fans have come from all over Europe to hear it. Domingo? A baritone? Well, he is 68 years old, and voices do tend to get lower as they age. But still, we had some questions about this transformation, so we turned to our music commentator, Miles Hoffman. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
And Miles, let's keep listening to Placido Domingo as a baritone.
Renee, that's Domingo singing the Verdi role of Simone Boccanegra. He was singing that at the Berlin State Opera. Domingo will be singing this all over Europe, actually, and he'll be singing at the Metropolitan Opera in 2010, again, as a baritone in Simone Boccanegra.
Well, yeah, there was a review in the Times of London that speculated as to why Domingo might be doing this, and its quip was that the singer might be aiming to end his career on a low note. that in a way, this right. He's trying to make sense career-wise out of some natural progression as far as his voice is.
Well, and that's true, but it's also a natural progression that went in the other direction, Renee. First of all, Domingo is a very interesting and intellectually curious and ambitious musician. He's always tried different things, and he has always had a rich lower register to his voice. And in fact, Placido Domingo started out his career as a baritone. He started as a baritone, and somewhere along the line, early on actually, people said, you know, Placido, I think you should try to sing tenor because that seems to be what your voice is even better suited for.
Why don't we listen then to the difference by taking a listen to someone who's made a career as a baritone?
I think that's a good idea, Renee. We can do a little A-B comparison. From the opera Simone Boccanegra, singing the same role, here is the great Italian baritone, Pier Cappuccilli. And now let's hear Domingo singing the same thing.
Does sound, if you could put it that way, it's a quite a pretty voice, but
exactly.
Less rich than Cappuccelli.
It's a beautiful voice and always has been. And in fact, Renee, the ranges, the actual pitch ranges, the notes that tenors and baritones sing are not that very different. What's different is the quality. Baritones have a richer, lower, darker quality. And when they sing up high, it sounds like somebody with a low voice trying to sing high. When Domingo sings high, it's easy for him. But one of the things we should stress here, Renee, is that different tenors have different qualities. If you listen to somebody like Pavarotti, Pavarotti never had that deep quality at the bottom of his voice, and Domingo never sang just bunches of high C's one after the other. Yeah, well, that's Pavarotti, Renee.
Yeah.
A totally different sound from Domingo.
Well, are you saying then in a way that singers are prisoners of the vocal cords that they were born with?
A little bit. Here's the thing. I'm never going to sound like James Earl Jones. And I can sing low notes, but I'm never going to sound like a basso. I'm not going to sound like a deep bass singer. Frankly, neither am I going to sound like a tenor, but that's a different story. We are born with certain physical equipment. What's interesting is that singers develop, and students starting out usually have to figure out at some point what their voice type is. They don't start out necessarily knowing their voice type. You see students in music schools arriving all the time having to figure out, am I a tenor, am I a baritone, am I a soprano, am I a mezzo-soprano?
Well, now, you've just mentioned sopranos. We've been talking about tenors and baritones. But assuming, of course, that everything you've just been saying is true for women singers as well?
It is, absolutely. A wonderful example of somebody who is, in some ways, like Domingo, would be the great soprano Maria Callas. She was famous for that aria. That's the aria Una Voce Poco Fa from Rossini's Barber of Seville. That's a coloratura, high aria. Now let's hear her sing a mezzo-soprano aria from Camille Saint-Saëns' opera Samson and Delilah. Callas, like Domingo, had this extraordinarily rich lower register, lower range, so she could do this. She could go from one to the other.
Well, apparently the opera world will be getting both from Placido Domingo in the coming years because his opera roles now are booked, as I understand it, 5 years into the future, and he's going to mix in now both tenor and baritone roles.
That's right. That's right, Renee. And it might be fun to go out with a recording of Domingo singing one of the most famous baritone roles in the repertoire, the role of Figaro in Rossini's Barber of Seville. And this is the Largo al Factotum, where he sings Figaro, 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 Figaro.
And Miles, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Renee. Hey!
Sorry to interrupt those Figaros. Just a reminder that that was Miles Hoffman, violist of the American Chamber Players and dean of the Petrie School of Music at Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina. To hear more Placido Domingo at both ends of his voice range, go to npr.org/music. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And now for an athletic contest that's drawing a huge audience in Canada by putting reality TV on ice. Battle of the Blades started last month on Canadian public television, and it has proved wildly popular with its live ice skating competition that pairs figure skaters with former players from the National Hockey League. We sent Anita Elash to find out what all the excitement is about.
The Canadian public broadcaster, CBC TV, is known for its news programs and documentaries. But this season, viewers on Sunday and Monday night are watching this.
Live from Maple Leaf Gardens, it's Battle of the Blades and the Monday night skate-off. Here we go, Latino Theme Week. Kurt, let's get ready to rumble.
Those are the MCs, Ron McLean, who does the play-by-play for Saturday night hockey games, and world figure skating champion Kurt Browning. This is the elimination round in week three of Battle of the Blades. Based on the previous night's performance, the two worst couples have been chosen for a skate-off.
Very good. Yes, indeed. Two pairs will step into the ring, and the judges tonight can save only one.
Oh, you're so serious.
As you might expect, the crowd goes wild as the first couple steps onto the ice and starts to rumba.
When marimba rhythms start to play.
But they're knocked out by the competition. Former Toronto Maple Leafs tough guy Ty Domi and Canadian Olympic figure skater Christine Huff Sweeney. They samba their way into Judge Dick Button's heart.
Ty, you really pulsated tonight. And I don't mind saying so.
It's a familiar format for reality TV. But this show is pulling at Canadian remote controls like almost no other locally grown program. When it debuted, nearly 2 million people watched. That's nearly twice as many as follow the CBC's most popular Sunday night drama. The fans who've come to watch say they were skeptical at first, but Tamara Cartwright says she's been won over.
One of the things is to see these big burly guys try and do some of the finesse. And who would ever have thought Ty Domi, who's the fighter, is now doing these arabesque and twisting around and holding as a love story. I think all Canadians are in shock of that one.
The show's popularity may be no surprise, given the amount of ice that forms during long Canadian winters. But executive producer Kevin Albrecht says it was tough to convince hockey players they could figure skate. He first approached Ty Domi 2 years ago.
His conversation with me went like all of the conversation with the hockey players. The first 10 minutes was kind of a look of disbelief in their eyes, just going, you know, is this a joke? Are you kidding me?
Albrecht finally signed up 8 former NHL hockey players and asked them all to exchange their hockey skates for figure skates. Montreal Canadian Claude Lemieux laced up his in September and has practiced with a team of coaches every day since. Today he's perfecting an overhead lift and reviewing it on tape.
See, that part's not good right there.
Lemieux says that during his first performance, he felt as much pressure as during a Stanley Cup final. Now he says the romantic songs are easy, but the fast ones are still tough.
When it's grooving and the hands are going and the head and the hips and the feet and the lifts, there's a lot of moving parts to it. It adds a little bit of pressure.
All that grooving is getting some attention outside Canada, too. Albrecht says he's received calls from Russia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, and the U.S. for producers who want the right to copy his idea. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
The economic downturn has not spared attorneys. Struggling law firms emerged, and some have downsized. A firm in Nashville, Bass, Berry & Sims, is among those that have laid off lawyers this year. The firm is now training less experienced attorneys with cheaper billing rates to take on trial work. From member station WPLN, Blake Farmer reports.
For a young attorney, the hardest thing about going to court for the first time is that he can't let anyone know it's his first time.
You have to really act like you own the place. Well, how can you do that if you've never been there before?
Mike Dagley is a partner at Bass, Berry & Sims and an experienced litigator. He's showing the firm's first-year associates how to at least look like they own the place. Dagley's experience allows him to charge clients more than twice the hourly billing rate of associates. Brian Iverson graduated from Pepperdine Law School in California last year and says he really wasn't trained to stand up in front of a jury.
Do you always comply with this policy?
Yes, we do.
Iverson is examining a witness as part of the firm's new in-house litigation training program. On Friday afternoons, for 6 months, senior attorneys played judges, interns took the jury seats, and 16 associates, like Iverson, argued the case. It's a commercial dispute over who pays for $500,000 of computer chips lost in the mail. Iverson takes a dramatic pause and turns on his heel.
And I'd like to talk to you about your assistant, Virginia Young.
The entire exercise was videotaped so the firm's rookie litigators could critique themselves. Iverson says it's almost embarrassing to see how close he stood to the jury.
I didn't really feel that I was kind of impeding on their space when we were doing that, but then go back and watch the video and I'm right on top of them.
In law school, you really learn substantive areas of the law, like the law of contracts or the law of evidence. You don't learn how do you persuade people in a courtroom setting.
Bass partner Mike Dagley says law school grads come to the firm without trial skills. The American Bar Association is midway through a 3-year review of its accreditation standards and could address the need for more litigation work. On-the-job training is getting harder because of a phenomenon known as the vanishing trial. Out-of-court resolutions have become the norm. Old-school litigators like Dagley learned in the apprentice style by working under senior attorneys until they were ready to go it alone.
Can you tell me about your first trial? Do you remember it?
It was in Dallas in 1983, and I was very inexperienced and very young.
But Dagley says when younger, less experienced attorneys have some basic trial skills, they're the right choice for some.
If you have smaller clients who have disputes with less at risk, then it makes more economic sense to put younger lawyers with lower billing rates on it.
Bass, Barry, and Sims would not identify clients of these young associates. The firm's not interested in advertising which companies are using unseasoned lawyers. Attorney instructor Henry Hecht of the Hecht Training Group says nothing can replace actual trial experience.
People talk about having your feet in the real fire as opposed to simulated training. It certainly can only go so far.
Still, Hecht says simulations are sometimes the best option. The cost of taking a commercial dispute to trial can easily top $1 million. Even clients looking for a discount want to win. So the question for them is whether saving thousands in legal fees is worth rolling the dice on a young lawyer who hasn't won before. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Over the past couple of years, as the foreclosure crisis has grown, NPR has been following the efforts of a pretty colorful housing advocate. His name is Bruce Marks, and he heads up the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, NACA. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, lately Marks has been on tour, where he says he's helped bring down loan payments for nearly 100,000 homeowners.
Bruce Marks only half-jokingly calls himself a non-violent bank terrorist. Back last winter, we did a story on Marks when he led several hundred people down the driveway and up to the mansion of a house where John Mack lives. Mack is the CEO of Morgan Stanley.
It's so outrageous. While Americans are losing their homes by the millions, he's living here in his beautiful house.
Marks has protested plenty of other executives who he says are not doing enough to avoid foreclosures. He's even posted on his website their photos and home phone numbers. Morgan Stanley said it's working with Marks' group. And for Marks, it's not just about the bullhorns. For 20 years, he's run a nonprofit that makes affordable home loans. And over the past year, he's doubled his staff and now has 1,200 employees nationwide.
If you have any questions, please feel free to locate your team.
We caught up with Marks at a very different sort of event in San Francisco. Lately, Marks has been running a foreclosure help roadshow. He calls it the Save the Dream Tour. His group at NACA rents out a stadium for several days, and a ton of people show up.
In Los Angeles, we had over 50,000 people there. Then in Phoenix, over 40,000 people. Vegas, over 45,000 people.
Housing counselors are set up at hundreds of tables across the floor of the stadium. Homeowners are told to bring their loan documents, W-2s, and other paperwork. Through his protests, Marks has pressured many of the major banks and other so-called loan servicing companies to sign agreements to work with him, and so they send representatives here too. And Mark says over the past year, his group's been able to renegotiate loans and get payments lowered for more than 90,000 homeowners.
I was in Las Vegas last weekend, and I finished up here today.
62-year-old Bernice Jackson is from Los Angeles. She drove hundreds of miles to come to these events. Jackson's husband is retired, and they're on a fixed income. She says a mortgage broker lied to them, and she got into a loan that she just couldn't afford.
Oh, man, I had a very high interest rate, and through NACA and the help of the servicers, I got the note reduced to 2%. So my note went from almost $4,000 a month to $1,600 a month. Yes. I'm very excited, very happy.
Now, that may sound too good to be true, but Marx's group pushes the banks to try to get a new payment that the homeowner can really afford. And that can make sense for the banks or the investors who own the loans. And actually, a very big-time investor has shown up here at this event.
Yeah, it's actually pretty unbelievable. Want to come see what they're doing and how they're doing it, and it's pretty impressive.
Scott Simon is a managing director for PIMCO. It's an investment firm that manages some $200 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. That makes him one of the biggest mortgage investors in the entire world. And here he is, standing in the midst of thousands of people looking to pay investors like him less money, and he thinks that's a good idea. In fact, he'd actually like to see more people getting their principal reduced. That's the amount that they owe. He says too many people are upside down, owing way more than their house is worth, and that doesn't give them much of an incentive to keep their house.
Well, I think that is right, because you're going to potentially have as many as 7 million people go into foreclosure unless they're helped over the next 3 years. So, you know, you're talking about 10% of households. You know, foreclosure is almost always the absolute worst thing can happen. It's bad for the homeowner. It's bad for the neighborhood. It's bad for the investors. It's bad for the system.
Simon would like to see more workouts where investors like him forgive a chunk of principal so that the loan can be refinanced at a market rate and the borrower isn't upside down anymore. Other investors have resisted these efforts. They think too many homeowners won't make even the lower payments, so they'll get foreclosed on anyway. But Bruce Marx estimates that about 75% of the homeowners that NACA gets a loan modification for keep making their payments. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And we're going to spend some time revisiting one of the greatest rivalries in the history of basketball, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. For more than a decade, they dominated the game, first in college and then in the NBA. It was the stoic versus the showman. For the Celtics, the big-nosed blonde whose intense personality matched his intense play as a forward.
With 3 seconds, Bird will try another jumper and hit it at the buzzer. Bird has 60 points.
And for the Lakers, the smooth point guard with the mile-wide smile who made even the most difficult moves look easy.
Campbell to Magic. Oh, gets away. What a pass. Hello. Count it.
Now, maybe Bird would have still soared without Magic pushing him, and maybe Magic would have still been magical without Larry Bird, but the NBA would not be where it is today without the rivalry that elevated the entire league. It's all detailed in their new book. It's called When the Game Was Ours, co-written with Jackie McMullen. Magic Johnson and Larry Bird both sat down with me recently, and from listening to them, it's clear they are now very good friends. But back in the day, that rivalry was real.
Well, we disliked each other. It didn't help that we played in an NCAA championship game, and now we got to see each other in the NBA, and one is for the Celtics, one for the Lakers, because once we entered into both of those teams, they hated each other, the organizations already. So even our teammates made sure that we hated each other. I mean, we're so competitive anyway that there was a dislike there. I even hated him more because I knew he could beat me.
You know, some people look at the two of you and the way that your relationship has evolved over the years, and there's still this question, how much of that rivalry came from the two of you? And the competition between the two of you, and how much of it was manufactured by the league?
Well, you got to go back in the 50s. We just rekindled the fire, but we did it in a way where we caught the imagination of everyone in America.
You know, I want to talk to you about a turning point in your relationship, and it seemed to be that moment when the two of you got together for the taping of the Converse shoe commercial. And before we go on, I think it'd be interesting if we just took a listen.
I heard Converse made a pair of Bird shoes.
for last year's MVP.
Yep.
Well, they made a pair of Magic shoes for this year's MVP.
Okay, Magic, show me what you got.
The Bird Shoe, the Magic Shoe. Choose your weapon from Converse.
We just heard the audio, so you don't see the visual, but Magic, you're in the limousine, and you jump out, and you know, you got the two shoes, and eventually they change the wording of that choose your weapon. But for a time, that commercial was legendary. How much did they have to convince both of you to get together to go to Indiana to tape that commercial?
Well, for you know, it was
probably
more.
Indiana.
I know.
So it didn't take much convincing it was for you.
It was probably more for me than for Larry. You know. You got me going to his hometown, and Larry and I had never really sat down and had a conversation. So I'm nervous. You know, I'm nervous. It's like I'm going crazy. Like, what's going to happen? And we started shooting a commercial, and we really didn't say anything to each other. We were just, you know, doing our lines and everything. And the real moment, and I'm sure Larry would agree, was when we went up to the house for lunch. And his mom gave me the biggest hug and hello. And right then, she had me. And then Larry and I sat down for lunch. And I tell you, we figured out, you know, we're so much alike. We're from the Midwest. We grew up poor. Our families is everything to us. Basketball is everything to us. You know, those type of things. And so that changed my whole outlook on Larry Bird.
In the book, they describe this meeting between the two of you, and they say that when you left, that Larry Bird seemed like a real down-to-earth guy, and you thought to yourself, huh, we could end up being friends one day. But then you had to go back to your teammates who were like, you did what? You went to his house?
I know. Believe me, everybody was shocked, right?
Well, that's one of the things that I was always nervous about when I played in the NBA. I always thought you had to keep the edge. A lot of things you do, you don't want to get too close to a person because you will get a little soft. But once me and Magic left that commercial shoot that day in Indiana, and once we got with our teams, all that was forgotten until we retired.
There's a chapter in this book that's called November 7th, 1991.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today.
The chapter begins with the words, you've got to call Larry. And that's Magic Johnson asking his agent at the time to call Larry Bird. Magic, there was a short list of people who you said had to know before you went before the cameras to make that announcement. But among all of your basketball colleagues, why was it so important to make sure that Larry Bird was at the top of that list?
Well, you know, probably for all the reasons we've been talking, we've been connected to each other since college. I knew that he would want to know and also want to know from me, and I'm glad that I was able to talk to Larry and let him know that I'm going to be okay, and I knew he was going to be supporting me, and I'm just glad that I was able to reach out to him.
Larry Bird, you still remember that phone call?
Well, it's something that I'll never forget. My whole life, but you know, we had a game that night, and I had my routine where I'd come home from shoot around, have my lunch, then go take a nap, and right when I started to lay down there, the phone rang, and it was probably one of the worst feelings you ever could imagine. At that time, HIV was known to be a death sentence, but for some reason, when he told me he was going to be fine, I believed him, because everything he's ever said really come to be true. I feel a little bit better, but still, I was a gamer. I always liked to play in the games. I loved game day. I couldn't wait to get down to the gym. But when I got that call, that's the one time that I can honestly tell you that I didn't feel like playing.
What did this period do to your friendship? It sounds like it deepened your friendship. And I ask this question because I wonder within the pages of this book if there's a lesson about the power of friendship.
Well, I think that, you know, both Larry and I are very strong, strong-willed, strong-minded. Sometimes that armor is weakened, and as strong as I appeared to be, I still needed a friend to just say, hey, man, just do what you got to do to be here for a long time. And that's I leaned on Larry Bird for that. we got a friendship. You don't have to talk every day, and we don't. And then when we do get together, when I see Larry and I get that pound and I get that hello, I'm good. You know, it takes me through my next year or two, you know, until I see him again.
Thanks to both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Larry Bird and Irvin Magic Johnson. They were talking to us about their careers and the new book, Larry Bird, Irvin Magic Johnson, When the Game Was Ours. The book was written by Jackie McMullen.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.